As we come to the end of this year, I want to take a moment to reflect on what this year of conversations have taught me about sleep, the human brain, and the people who trust us with their nights. This year, I had the privilege of speaking with clinicians, physicians, and researchers who work at the front lines of sleep medicine. And each conversation reshaped how I think about sleep in a deeper way. And before we dive in, I want to say something personal. This year, I was honored to be named Sleep Podcast of the Year by Dr. Chris Winter on his podcast, Sleep Unplugged. I don't take this lightly. This recognition belongs to every guest, every listener, and every patient who keeps reminding me why sleep education matters. Today, I want to summarize four meaningful conversations from 2025. The first one, what parents misunderstand about children's sleep terrors. So one of the most meaningful conversations this year was an interview I participated for the Society of Behavioral Sleep Medicine Outreach and Public Education Committee, focused on children's sleep terrors. The guest speaker was Dr. Sarah Honecker, an expert in children and teenagers' sleep. In this interview, she covered some key takeaway points for parents. Sleep terrors are not nightmares. A sleep terror is an asleep phenomenon. The child may look awake, even crying, screaming, and distressed, but their brain waves show they're still asleep. This is why parents are often so alarmed, even though the child usually have no memory of the episode. Parents often assume sleep terrors are caused by trauma, emotional distress, or something psychologically wrong. But that's usually not the case. Sleep terror are largely genetic. They tend to run in families and are closely linked to sleepwalking. Here's a part that surprised most parents. Sleep terrors have no known negative consequences for the child's emotional development. The child usually have no memory of the event. The distress belongs to the adults in the room, not the child. The most helpful thing parents can do is to ensure safety, but not try to wake the child. Let the episode pass. Sometimes, something as simple as 20 to 30 minutes of extra sleep can significantly reduce night terrors. The second part, nightmares are treatable, and that changes everything. Another conversation that deeply stayed with me was my interview with Dr. Courtney Warley on nightmares. She is an expert in treating nightmares and recently published a book called The Nightmare and Sleep Disorder Toolkit. Our conversation focuses on one powerful idea. Nightmares are common, and nightmare disorder is treatable. Recovery is possible even if you had nightmares for decades. She shared the story of a patient who said, "For the first time in 45 years, I did not have a nightmare this week." Exciting, right? Nightmares tend to occur in our REM sleep, when emotional processing is active and the rational brain is relatively offline. And one important misconception we discussed is this: avoiding sleep or using alcohol to knock yourself out often makes nightmares worse, not better. Both strategies disrupt REM sleep, and that increases nightmare frequency. So treatments like imagery rehearsal therapy, CBT for nightmares, and even lucid dreaming skills can give people back a sense of control. What this conversation reinforced for me is that improving sleep rarely starts at night. It often starts during the day. In how we regulate emotion, stress, and expectations. The third part, sleep apnea, is never just snoring. So several episodes this year reinforced one message I wish more people heard earlier. Snoring is not benign. It is a problem, and it's something you should pay attention to. In my conversation with Dr. Christopher Allen, he mentioned, obstructive sleep apnea does not cancel out other sleep disorders. It often worsens them. You cannot diagnose sleep apnea by looking at someone. And snoring is not a sign of deep sleep. It's a sign of partial airway obstruction. Repeated oxygen drops during sleep damage memory centers like the hippocampus and increase long-term risk for cognitive decline. So sleep apnea could be a slow killer, not because it's dramatic, but because it's silent. If you do have sleep apnea, CPAP is a gold standard treatment, but it's not the only option. Oral appliance, myofunctional therapy, nerve stimulation, weight loss medications, any of those or all of this could be helpful to you. But be careful. Treatment should be individualized. Please talk to your doctor and figure out what's the best treatment plan for you. The last part, precision, not guesswork. So one of the most intellectually exciting conversations I had this year was with Dr. Kendall Stewart. He approaches sleep through the lens of genetics and neurochemistry. This episode will be published soon, but I want to share a few key ideas that really stayed with me. One core message from that conversation was this: sleep problems are not just behavioral, and they are not just psychological. They are also biochemical. In other words, it's not simply about habits, willpower, or mindset. It's also about how the brain is wired, how neurotransmitters function, and how efficiently the brain clears and resets itself during sleep. One line from that conversation really stood out to me. It's not about how much of a neurotransmitter you have. It's about balance, timing, and clearance. For example, we talked about the balance between GABA and glutamate, the brain's braking system and acceleration system. We also talked about melatonin not as a sleeping pill, but as a timing signal, and how some people's receptors are simply more or less sensitive. And we talk about dopamine, not just as reward chemical, but as something deeply involved in REM sleep and dream regulation. What this conversation helped me articulate is something I've been feeling in my clinical work for a long time. Therapy works best when the brain is biologically ready to change. Behavioral sleep medicine and precision medicine are not competing approaches. They actually work best together. When we understand both the behavior and the biology, we stop guessing and we start tailoring treatment to the person in front of us. At the end, I want to share this. This year reminded me that sleep medicine is not about quick fixes. It's about listening to physiology, to psychology, to families, and to the quiet signals the body sends at night and during the day. I'm deeply grateful to every guest who shared their expertise, to every listener who trusted this space, and to colleagues like Dr. Chris Winter, who remind me that thoughtful, evidence-based sleep education still matters. If this podcast helped you understand your sleep, or your child's sleep just a little better this year, then it has done its job. Thank you for going deep into sleep with me this year, and I wish you a happy new year. I'm Dr. Yishan. Look forward to seeing you in 2026. and continue this journey together. Bye.